This podcast is brought to you by Watch City Research, your user research partner. Check out watchcityresearch.com for insightful blog posts and to learn more about our UX research services. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the 97 UX Things podcast. This is your host and editor of the book, Dan Berlin. This week, we are joined by Kyle Soucy, who wrote the chapter, Data Alone Does Not Create Empathy, Storytelling is Key. Happy to have you on the podcast, and welcome, Kyle.
Thanks, Dan. Happy to be here.
Awesome. So, Kyle, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Yeah. So I've been working as an independent UX research consultant for the last 17 years. And that's just a fancy way to say I freelance. My company is called Usable Interface. And I just specialize in conducting usability testing and user research studies and also training teams to conduct their own research.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So over the years, I've just worked on a lot of different products, everything, you know, desktop, mobile apps, websites, medical devices, and even kitchen appliances and home entertainment systems.
Nice. Yeah. Is there one or two methodologies that you focus on?
I really love just moderated usability testing, in-depth interviews. I really like when I'm doing more foundational research, you know, before the product's even created and trying to understand a little more about who these people are and, you know, how to design for their world. I like doing kind of out-of-the-box methods like collaging, getting people to build collages to reflect how they feel or think about a certain situation. I find that to be so much more effective than just sitting down with a clipboard and predefined questions and just get them to open up and do an activity and get them thinking a little differently. So anything that can kind of break the ice in a fun way, I'm definitely a part of. It's hard. You know, doing research and sitting down with someone with such a short period of time and, you know, being a complete stranger and getting them to open up about sometimes sensitive topics.
Yep. And you introduced me to collaging years ago. It's just a wonderful methodology, getting people to tell stories, and thanks for that. It's just a great way to get people talking.
Yeah, I really love it. And whenever I do it, I'm always just amazed by the results. It never fails.
Yep. Yeah. Agreed. A lot of prep work, but it's worth it.
Yeah.
So Kyle, can you tell us a little bit about your career trajectory? How did you discover UX and wind up doing freelancing for so long?
Yeah. So I went to school to become a developer. And I never thought I'd end up in this world because I didn't even know it existed at the time. You know, my first job at a school was with a startup. And it was a lot of fun, but everything we were building was just hard to use. It was not very pretty or eloquent at all. And I didn't know how to make it better. And during that time, it was during like this dot-com boom where everybody was burning money like mad. And, you know, I asked to attend all sorts of different conferences, which they let me do. And I ended up at a conference called Internet World in New York City. And I'll never forget it. That was the first time I ever heard the term usability and information architecture. And I was completely hooked. I was like, this is what we're not doing. This makes perfect sense. And in school, I always switched majors back and forth between psychology and computer science. And it just seemed like the perfect mix of two worlds where I loved both. I'm like, this is it. So when the dot-com bubble burst and everybody lost their job, I'm like, this is going to be my next job, this usability thing that I didn't even know what it was. And I ended up getting a job as a web architect doing front-end coding instead of back-end. And I eventually just turned that job into the job I wanted. I educated them on usability, a wireframe process, testing, and ended up doing those things. And from that point on, that was it. From, I guess it was 2000 on, I was in the industry. And at that point, nobody was in the industry. It was like amazing if you could find someone else doing what you do. You were usually the one and only person in a company doing it. So, but, you know, very quickly working internally just got, I wanted to do contracting or consulting and having a lot of variety of different things to work on. That's what I really love. And I got very active in the local community. And that was really important, I think, to me getting into consulting. I've always been a big fan of getting people involved in the UX community. And when I was living back, so I'm originally from Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. I moved up to New Hampshire, where I'm at now, in 2006. And when I lived in Philly, I was, you know, the chair of Philly Chi. When I moved up to New Hampshire, I helped start the New Hampshire chapter of the UXPA. And ever since then, I've been a board member. So to me, it's just important to be active in the community. It's a good way to find work, but it's also a good way to help other people. I'm also a mentoring director for the IA conference, which involves running their career center and helping people get into the industry. So it's a great thing. I think it's important to give back to the community, and because it is new, it's not an industry that's been around for that long. It's not like 50 years, you know, that we need each other to grow it and to learn from one another.
To find best practices, to do the to learn how to best advocate for our field and the corporate sphere, learn a lot from each other, and that's
absolutely
one of the best things about the community is how open the community can be, and with conferences and books. Hey,
yeah.
You mentioned Internet World. I remember Internet World from back in the day. Do you remember what caught your eye about usability during that?
Well, it was, I remember the presenter, and I wish I could remember her name at the time. I haven't heard or seen anything from her in ages, but she was doing a card sorting exercise.
Nice.
And it blew my mind. I was like, wow, people think about, you know, categorizing information in different ways, and they have different mental models. And it made complete sense, especially the exercise she took us through. And then she showed, you know, what a usability test looks like. And I'm like, yes, this is exactly what I know my higher ups at the company needed to hear, because they weren't listening to me. They needed to hear the end users saying what I'm saying, you know, that it, you know, this needed to be improved, and that would carry much more weight. So that just spoke to me that it seems so simple and so obvious, but it just wasn't happening, you know?
Yeah. Great. Thanks for that. So moving on to your chapter, tell us a little bit about your chapter. Data alone does not create empathy. Storytelling is key.
Yeah. So my chapter is all about the importance of presenting research findings. And when I say that, I mean, not just writing a report, but actually getting up in front of people and sharing the user's story in a compelling way. And I wanted to write about this because I know that when I first started as a UX researcher, I was just laser focused on learning how to moderate the perfect interview. I thought that that was everything, that, you know, if you're going to do this job right, you better be able to do a, you know, kick-ass interview. Yep. And I didn't really give much thought to presenting. And I didn't realize it was so important. I didn't realize that moderating is really only half of our job. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if you have this great research finding, if nobody's really acting upon it and really understanding the importance of it. And what I know now is that really the best researchers are not just great interviewers. They're also amazing presenters and storytellers. And, you know, prior to getting into this profession, I really didn't know how much public speaking was involved. And honestly, if I did, I probably would have ran away. Right. Because at that time, you know, early 2000, I would never willingly get up in front of anyone. And I'm not just talking about speaking at a conference, but just, you know, running kickoff meetings, running debriefs with observers, or conducting data analysis workshops, or presenting findings. That just sounded like death to me. I would have a shaky, quivery voice, you know, red ears, the whole nine yards.
Yep.
And it took a long time for not only for me to get better and more and comfortable doing it, but actually wanting to present and actually putting myself out there at conferences and wanting to teach. And it's amazing. I try to tell people that if you're nervous, totally get it. But if I can do it, I've come a long way. Even my mom will say, like, I can't believe what you do now. I'm like, I know, me neither. Because it was just such a rocky start.
I didn't even know that. You're such an amazing presenter, and you know, and to watch you present, it's so natural. That's fascinating.
Oh, thanks for that. But yeah, I can tell you, I'm kind of cringing right now because it's all an act. I will tell you, like, I have to mentally prep for it. I have to be really prepared. And that's my number one advice to anyone. I don't care if it's just a business meeting or a conference presentation. Know your stuff forwards and backwards, because that's going to give you the confidence that you need to just talk. And, you know, I feel like it's really important to, you know, advise those that are coming into this industry, especially UX research, that it's the importance of presenting the findings, and you can't just hand over a report and expect that to do the work for you.
Yep.
I used to actually do that, where I'd hand in my report and hope and pray nobody would, like, not ask me questions about it, but ask me to present to an audience on it. And now I fight for that. I tell people that you know, if anything, avoid that report. You know, nobody's going to read it anyway. Get that 1 hour presentation of the key findings, get in front of them, let them know what the aha moments were that they had to hear about, what they paid to hear about, you know? So that was really, if I could think of one thing that would be key advice. I remember when you were asking about getting people to contribute to the book, like, what would be the key advice you would give someone? That was it. And I'm like, I need to write about this. To me, being a good storyteller or presenter in general, it's all about having that connection with your audience and conveying emotion. If you don't have any energy whatsoever, nobody else is, because energy is contagious. If you have passion, if you're excited about something, someone else will get that too. They're going to feel that. And that's so key, so important. And I think that's really, truly the difference between someone that keeps you on the edge of your seat and the ones that, you know, put you to sleep.
Yeah, totally.
You know, two people can be presenting the same data, and one's putting them to sleep, one's keeping them, you know, really interested. It's all about, you know, how engaged you are.
So how do we turn the reports that we're used to into these more storytelling experiences where we can keep people on the edge of their seat?
Yeah, so I think that we typically bore people right off the bat by taking our report and presenting it. So rather than having that separate deck, you know, that separate presentation deck, we tend to say, here's a report that you would not read. I'm going to read it to you. And nobody wants to sit through that. I think the thing to do is to really shake it up a little bit and to not necessarily lead off with the most boring details, which a report tends to do. A report, you start off with, you know, here's our methodology, here's who we talked to, here's why we talked to them, here's the goals of the research. And really, you want to really wow them with, like, here's the main finding. Like, if somebody had to bail in that meeting after 15 minutes, they're going to walk away knowing at least a couple findings that were key. But 15, 20 minutes into a typical readout or research readout or presentation, you're still just finally trying to get to those findings.
Right.
And that's hard to do because it's become so ingrained in our industry to present our research that way. Mike Montero has a great word for this. I think he calls it proactive defensiveness when we present, you know, all the methodology up front, you know, and not just get to the meat of it. And I think that is, it's interesting.
That's great. Yeah. Trying to prove what we're doing is legitimate before we actually get, you know, to the good stuff. And we're burying the lead while we're at it.
Right. Burying the lead. That is exactly what he said. It is so, so very key not to do that.
Right.
And when people are just, you know, I have people who bail on me all the time where it's like, okay, this meeting's an hour long. I can only stay for the first half hour.
Yep.
It's like, get used to that. You know, make sure you're getting it out quickly. And if you do, then they're more intrigued for that second half.
Right. Right. Hook them. And then you can get them into the details and why the details are important.
Right. And you know, another key thing that I see often missed is making that connection. Like, here's the big aha moment, but also here's why you should care about that. Mm. You know, what is the implication of that finding? It might seem obvious to you, but really, we really have to connect that dot and make it obvious to other people. And the tricky thing is, depending on who's attending your research readout, different people at the table could have different reasons why they care. And right. It's really on us to know that and to speak to them and to understand their perspective, because that's how you're going to get buy-in and action. I mean, the whole reason why we present, the whole reason why we get in front of someone and tell them a story is really to get them to feel, to get them to connect, and to get them to take action on the mm-hmm. recommendations we're making.
Yep.
A report just doesn't do that. And a bad presentation just doesn't do that either.
And it sounds like you're sort of advocating for, I guess it's almost separate documents where we have a presentation that leads into the storytelling as opposed to the report, which has the details.
Yes. And it takes more time definitely to do this. And I know it's kind of hard to say, but I've got the deck done, the report's sure. done. I can just chop out a few slides, but presenting is an art, and it really requires different visuals, usually a different order. Sometimes you really have to pull things out in a way. Usually my presentation decks are twice as long as my report decks, but they're filled with much less content, which is funny. But I like to just have very minimal words on the deck, but I'm just flipping through them quickly, not too quickly, but it's much more impactful when you can really zero in on, whether it's a key quote or a finding, and instead of having it lost in paragraphs of content on a slide. So I feel like they have a totally different look and feel. So they're two different deliverables, a report and a presentation. And really, we should be looking as an industry as the presentation is just the teaser to get them to read the darn report.
Right.
Yeah. Because an hour presenting the key findings, you're never going to be able to present everything.
Yep.
And if you do, it's usually too quick,
And going back to almost what we were talking about earlier, there's this timeline of storytelling where we are trying to get stories from our participants and to learn from them. And then it's up to us to pull out the insights from those and tell their story, tell our users' stories to the stakeholders.
Yes. Yes. And telling their story. I mean, that is so key. I feel like we have such a privilege being able to go into people's homes, mm-hmm. to go, into their work, wherever it may be, even remotely, but taking the time to talk to them and them giving us their time, that the least we can do is make sure to really share their story in a compelling way, gets people to act and gets people to really listen and to hear their story, which is really important. It's key to getting an understanding as to what works for them, how we should design for them.
Mm-hmm. How about for folks who aren't used to that presentation style and storytelling in front of an audience? Any tips for those folks?
Yeah, it wasn't, like I said before, it was not natural for me at all. What helped me the most was really watching other presenters and seeing what they did and honestly mimicking them. And even though it didn't feel comfortable, practice was really key.
Yeah.
I remember, when it came to conferences and, that is a very different presentation format. I honestly, I love that much more than I do presenting,
sure.
Research findings. It's because you can get fun with it. But, starting off with something visual, take away the here's who we talk to slide and here's all the demographic data about the participants. Instead, just boom. If you want to learn if you want to know anything about the study, this is the key thing.
Yep.
And start with that. That in and of itself will change everything. It'll change how you tell the story. And if you could start by just doing something different, that would be one thing I would try. You can have an appendix. You can say, hey,
yep.
if you have time, read the report. There's so much more data about, you want to know who we talk to. And usually the people who want to know that, they're looking to poke holes in your research. If you're doing your job correctly, everything should be sound. There should be no holes to have to worry about. But if somebody wants to try and figure out, you know, can we really trust these findings? They can have that data later.
Yep.
That presentation is not the time and place to defend it.
That's wonderful. Wonderful. Any other thoughts on this topic, on your chapter, before we move on to the tip for our listeners?
Let's see here. Any other things? You know, there was something. So Mike Montero, he did a workshop on presenting work, which, like I mentioned before, very different from presenting at a conference,
yep,
just presenting our work. And it was for designers, researchers, anyone. And I just took it recently, just a few months ago, and I thought it was really wonderful. And I would highly suggest anybody to check it out. But he said something that was so important. I do have a tendency to talk fast, and to try to cram a lot in because I'm usually excited about it and I want them to get excited. And he just said, you can never, ever, ever present too slowly.
Oh.
The less you say and the slower you say it, the more confident you sound. And I was like, oh my gosh, I need that tattooed like on my arm. And it's so true. And it's probably the most common advice that you get for public speaking. But it was really profound. And I would say, I would echo that completely. I'm not the best example of it at times.
Yep.
I try my hardest, but I'm always learning, and I will always sit in on any public speaking workshops, tips, you know, books, articles on that. It's something I can always improve on. And I think we should all really work on that because it is so key to what we do.
So tell your stories, but tell them slowly.
Yeah.
Nice. Great. This has been a wonderful conversation. Thanks for digging into your chapter with us. How about a tip for folks either breaking into UX or continuing with their UX career? What tip do you have for everyone?
I would say this sounds horrible, but I would say it's a hustle. Hustle your butt off. If you're trying to get into the industry, don't get discouraged if you're not landing your dream job or have, you know, any job offer in UX after just a few months of looking.
Yep.
I see it so often, and I mentor a lot of folks, and I don't want to burst anyone's bubble, but it can sometimes take 1 to 2 years. And I will tell you that that is completely our fault as an industry. Hmm. I think the hiring process for the UX industry is totally broken.
Totally.
It's just a hot mess. But it is, you know, a hot industry, and everyone is looking for someone experienced already.
Yeah.
So you get through that, you know, that frustrating time period where it's like, you know, I went through the program. Whether it's a degree program or whether it's General Assembly or whatever it may be, I see it from both ends. You really just have to make connections to get that first job. It's all about who you know. Get out there, network, go to your chapter meetings, and really live and breathe this stuff. You know, follow people on Twitter, get involved in the conversations, read everything you can on it. And just become active. Offer your services for free to get experience. One of the people I'm mentoring now, he will often just note-take while I am conducting research. And that gives him a great way to shadow me. He can learn my interview tips and techniques. He can learn from my pitfalls and the things that I do wrong. And he's also learning note-taking skills. He's participating in debriefs. It's a great way to jump into the industry and get some experience, whether you're getting paid or not. I believe you should, but you know, you can offer it up for free just as a way to break in.
Yep.
And don't feel like that's a bad thing, because what that gives you, not only just the experience, is when you're in an interview situation, you can actually talk from the heart authentically about what you learned there and how you contributed. And it, you know, when people are like, have you ever been in this kind of situation? You can actually say, yes, I have. And this is how I responded to that. And that's what you need. You really need that experience.
Yeah. Well, it's always talking about results that you've achieved and how you achieve those in those interviews. That's always best. And what you just said, you know, really sets you up for that.
Yeah, definitely.
And something I want to echo is the always be networking point is that, you know, that all jobs are getting gotten through networking these days. And then when there are lots of outlets to do so, whether it's UXPA chapter meetings or meetups or CHI, if it's that's in your area, or whatever the local UX organization in your area is, get out there and be a part of it.
Yes, there is no shortage of UX groups, that's for sure. Yep. And now everything's virtual. It's just, there's just no excuse not to get involved.
It's true. And and I hadn't thought about our broken UX hiring world in a while, but I want to echo that as well, because I have seen a lot of frustrated people who want, who have a desired trajectory in mind, but because the process is so broken and a lot of companies don't know how to hire UXers, or, you know, they create job descriptions that are bananas, and there's a mismatch there. It does make it frustrating. So hanging in there and finding the right thing, well, does take time, and just hang in there.
Yes. Yeah. And hustle.
Yeah, hustle. And it's worth the time, because once you do find your spot, you're good to go.
That's what I keep telling them. I said, you know, once you get that first job, you're golden. Mm-hmm. You're golden. Just hang in there. It'll happen.
Yep. Great. Well, Kyle, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I loved it.
Excellent. And thanks for listening, everyone. And hope you enjoyed this episode. The 97 UX Things podcast is a companion to the book 97 Things Every UX Practitioner Should Know, published by O'Reilly, and all book royalties go to UX nonprofits. The theme music is Iron Lung by King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard, and I'm your host and book editor, Dan Berlin. Please remember to find the needs in your community and fill them with your best work. Thanks for listening.